Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the massive New York Times investigation into the extent to which Trump is the self-made man he claims to be, and speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter David K. Johnson, the co-founder of DCReport.org and the author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. He joins us to discuss how Trump, thanks to his father, became a millionaire at the age of 8, and through his 40s and 50s received more than $5 million a year from Fred Trump. But more importantly, Trump received the equivalent today of $413 million from his father to get started in real estate, even though Trump repeatedly claims that he built what he built himself without any help from his dad. We will also look into how much Fred Trump bailed out his son from big bets that went bust, like Trump Shuttle, the Plaza Hotel, and the Atlantic City casinos, to the tune of $140 million in today's dollars, much of which was never repaid. Then we'll speak with Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, about his article at The Atlantic, What Happened to Lindsey Graham? We will discuss how, since the death of Senator Graham's close friend and moral conscience, John McCain, the senator has gone overboard embracing Trump to the point where he has become the most outspoken champion of Trump's embattled nominee to the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh. It is no small irony that when Congressman Lindsey Graham was one of the most zealous members of the House Judiciary Committee in pursuing the impeachment of President Clinton, he worked closely with Brett Kavanaugh. Back then, Graham made the case that the main issue was Clinton's perjury, not the extramarital sex he lied about. And now that perjury is the main issue at hand with Kavanaugh, not sexual assault or a weakness for brewskis, Graham is Kavanaugh's most ardent defender. Then finally, we will assess what kind of an improvement over NAFTA the new USMCA agreement is now that President Trump is singing its praises and claiming that his slapping tariffs on Mexico and Canada and getting tough with them are the reasons why he got the agreement. Matt Gold, a professor of law at Fordham University who held an appointment in the executive office of the president as the deputy assistant U.S. trade representative for North America, joins us to discuss how the modest gains in the new agreement are not worth the rancor and resentment Trump has stirred up with our neighbors. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump. He has lectured on economics, journalism, and tax policy on every continent except Antarctica, and is a former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, and he recently co-founded DCReport.org, and his latest book is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, Ian, thank you for having me on again.
Well, thanks for joining us on this busy news day. Not that every day lately is a busy news day, but the New York Times have done an extraordinary investigation into the origins of Trump as the self-made billionaire that he claims to be. And it turns out that his father made him a millionaire at the age of 8, and during Trump's 40s and 50s, he was receiving more than $5 million a year from his father. And then when he decided to go into the real estate business, his father gave him the equivalent in today's dollars of $413 million. Much of this, of course, was not repaid and was covered up in dubious tax schemes. So walk us through what you think are the highlights of this extraordinary piece of investigative reporting from the New York Times.
Well, it's relevant to two things here. One is I was the Times tax reporter for 13 years and, of course, have covered Donald longer than anybody else, more than 30 years. So I have a lot of deep knowledge of many of these events. Donald Trump and the Trump family have been liars and cheats for forever. And the Times documents, for example, invoicing schemes, which are a common way to cheat. You buy something, they show in one case, for $640, but you put down in your books that it cost you almost $1,000. And therefore, you get a much bigger tax write-off from it. And they show that this wasn't a one-off experience. There were 295 separate invoicing schemes that Fred Trump used to cheat the government and transfer money to his children, one of whom to this day is a sitting federal judge, Marianne Trump Barry. The Times says that it has, and I'm sure they do, hundreds of thousands of pages of documents provided to them. And they've got sworn testimony by Donald's brother, Robert, about one of the invoicing schemes where, under oath, he admits that they're doing this. Given that we know from other records before this that Donald Trump cheated Polish workers who were in the country without permission out of their enormous $4-an-hour pay, a judge held that he had engaged in a conspiracy to cheat those workers, that he cheated the city of New York out of $3 million of rent and went to extraordinary lengths to hide books and records so that he could get away with cheating, and that the only known case of cheating a gambler in Atlantic City was at the Trump's Castle Casino, together with a lot of other evidence. This is a really extraordinary job of nailing down, bolting down thoroughly that the president of the United States is a criminal. Now, most of the items described in the Times reporting are not any longer eligible for criminal prosecution because of statutes of limitations. There's some minor exceptions you could get around them, but I doubt we will see that. But there is no federal or New York State statute of limitations on civil tax fraud. This is one of the reasons that since June 15th at D.C. Report and elsewhere, I have been calling for a criminal investigation of the Trump tax returns in the expectation that they may find criminal charges they can bring on events that have happened from 2011 forward, but certainly to bring civil charges to collect the hundreds of millions of dollars, which with penalties and interest would now be well over $1 billion, that Donald Trump owes the federal government and the state of New York.
So on top of all that, of course, David K. Johnson, Trump is a complete liar in terms of fabricating his mythology of being the self-made billionaire, because in his books and on his TV show and on the campaign trail, he's always talked about how he began building his own empire and that the only financial help that he got from his father, Fred Trump, was a $1 million loan. And not only that, Trump went on to say, I had to pay him back with interest. Turns out that he stiffed his father.
Well, it turns out his father gave him, the Times calculates, $430 million. And one of the schemes they show is that when Donald was in need of some money, actually wasn't in need of money. In 1987, he was flush with money. His father paid $15.5 million for a partial interest in a Donald Trump apartment building in Manhattan. Not Trump Tower, but Trump Plaza. And 4 years later, he sold it back for $10,000. That's just a tax evasion scheme, plain and simple. And the four-year time period is significant because of an issue in terms of IRS internal record keeping. Somebody knew that if they waited 4 years, that would be smarter. They would have been really smart to wait 6 years. But the Donald Trump's whole story that I'm a self-made man, the Times shows, is completely bogus, and they show it with the internal family records, not just public filings, but somebody has clearly given them books and ledger sheets from within the government. And secondly, Ian, and I think this is really important, Donald Trump during the campaign kept telling us he was worth more than $10 billion. Nobody but D.C. Report or those who reprinted us has pointed out that his statement of net worth filed under penalty of perjury after he became president was only $1.4 billion. So virtually 90% of his claimed wealth disappeared between the day of voting in 2016 and the day he took office 10 weeks later. And even that statement shows grossly inflated values, and because of peculiar federal rules, does not show all of his debt. There is not now, Ian, and there never has been, one scintilla of verifiable evidence that Donald Trump is or ever was a billionaire.
Well, but David, he is the greatest president the American people have ever had, and in 2 years he's done more than any other president in the history of the United States.
Yes, and, you know, I'm an incredibly handsome movie star my own mansion in Beverly Hills. I mean, Donald just makes stuff up. He's done this his whole life. He's gotten away with it because he's a good story. The one thing that journalists are always in the tank for is a good story. And the Times points out that and names a small group of us, the late, great Wayne Barrett, who was the first person to get onto Trump, me, the second, Gwenda Blair, who did a multi-generation history of the Trump family, and Tim O'Brien, my former New York Times colleague, who wrote Trump Nation, that except for us, basically everybody bought his BS, and they continue to buy it. Right. And
a third of the country bought it, David.
Yeah, it is just incredible. I mean, I get emails and notes and people responding to my Twitter feed all the time that, you know, this is the greatest president of all times. I'm an idiot. He's of this and that. And it shows how we in America have failed to develop critical thinking skills, and that's because our education system was designed as we were leaving the agricultural world of the past for the industrial world that came about in this country starting about 1865. And we produced drones, people who are not supposed to ask critical questions. And so lots of people, they don't have the capacity. They were never taught. Here is how you critically evaluate things. Here is how you listen to claims and understand their truth or falsity. But this New York Times piece makes it, I think, absolutely mandatory for two things to happen. Congress must begin an investigation of Trump, and if the Republicans won't do it, the Democrats need to promise that, assuming they get control of the House or Senate, it is what they will start on January 3rd of next year when the new Congress takes hold. And secondly, Judge Marianne Trump Barry must remove herself from the bench immediately, and if she doesn't do so, then the executive office of the courts or whoever is responsible, I have to look up who that is, has to prevent her from hearing any cases, because the implication here is that she is the beneficiary of decades of criminal behavior.
And again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investor reporter and best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump. He has lectured on economics, journalism, and tax policy on every continent except Antarctica, and is a former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors. And he recently co-founded DCReport.org. And his latest book is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Let's talk about, though, how not only did Fred Trump get Donald Trump started in business with $413 million in today's dollars when Trump said he didn't get a dime from his dad, he got $1 million. And not only that, he had to pay...
As a loan.
Yeah, as a loan, and he had to pay him back, all of which is bogus. But when Trump... In the 1980s, some of his big bets went bust, like Trump Shuttle, the Plaza Hotel, and the Atlantic City casinos. Fred Trump again steps in, and one of the most amazing things that he did, and you've pointed out before that Donald Trump is the only American businessman who, in a casino where the house always wins, managed to go broke. But the father, apparently, what he did was he bought $3.5 million in casino chips at Trump's Atlantic City casino.
Yeah, that, Ian, is not new. I reported on that when I was at the Philadelphia Inquirer covering Atlantic City in 1990. The Wall Street Journal broke that story. They got out there ahead of me, to their credit. But this was a typical scheme. In Atlantic City, to make sure the mob was not involved, there were rules about putting money in. You couldn't be a hidden investor like we know mob guys were in Las Vegas. And when Donald couldn't make a bond payment, his lawyer came down with $3.5 million in cash, bought chips, and then left without gambling. The state later fined Donald, I don't know, $30,000 or $40,000, a slap on the wrist. And that $3.5 million meant that Donald had enough cash to pay his bondholders. Because Donald's whole scheme is what you're seeing him do to the federal government now. You just borrow money like crazy and don't worry about it and spend it, and then you don't pay people back. In fact, he said once, I borrowed money knowing I wouldn't pay it back. If that isn't a criminal statement, I don't know what is. And I've been writing about criminals for a half a century.
So... why do you think so many people in this country bought this idea? Is it this aspirational politics that somehow we can all win the lottery, or that somehow that all this gold, you know, there's an old joke in Hollywood, you tear off the off the tinsel of Hollywood, and underneath there's real tinsel. In his case, you know, you peel off the gold.
And there's dross there. Right. Well, Ian, I think there are two big factors here. I mean, one is that Martin Luther King said he wanted a society where we would judge people by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. And instead, with money porn, we have created a society where we judge people by the content of their wallet, or in Donald's case, the claimed content of their wallet. So there's that one aspect of it. But the much deeper aspect is that both political parties have failed to deal with the needs and wants and reasonable expectations of ordinary Americans. Today, the bottom 90% of Americans are making only a tiny bit more money when you adjust for inflation than they made in 1968, 50 years ago. And when you look at housing, for every dollar of equity, Americans overall have added to the housing they have, they've taken on $2 of debt. That's not a prescription for prosperity. That is a prescription for being on a hamster wheel until you drop dead. We have cut back on the things like education. I mean, when I went to college in California in the 60s and 70s, it was literally free. I paid Foothill Junior College in 1968-69 in today's dollars, $120, and $90 of that was for a parking permit. So I paid $30 to go to college. Anybody who has a kid in college or is paying off student debt knows that even at junior colleges now, it's 10 grand a year. And we've done a whole variety of things that have redistributed money to those at the top. Now, I wrote a trilogy about this, Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print. And in 2012, when the last book came out, I said on TV, anybody who runs for president on the economics in this book will get elected. And I know Donald saw me saying this because he called other people, and his economics, not his racism and all the other stuff, but his economics, a lot of it comes right out of the key points I made in those books. Donald didn't read them, but he saw me on TV talking about them. You know, Washington has been taking care of rich people and itself, not you. We need to drain the swamp, et cetera, et cetera. And Donald is a master marketer. And this is a guy who knows how to sell nonsense and get people to believe him. Remember, this is a man who got national news coverage of his claim back in 1990 that the actress Kim Basinger, who was a big deal back then, Madonna, and Carla Bruni, who later became the First Lady of France, were sleeping with him. Absolute made-up nonsense. But more importantly, why would, you know, alleged self-proclaimed billionaire says he's sleeping with women, not his wife, why would that be national news? Well, I mean,
well,
like,
you just have to go through the checkout at the supermarket to answer that question. Except,
well,
it's not
yes,
the national news.
It's
his buddy at
the money porn. Right. It's part of the money porn problem in this
right.
country.
Well, we got a minute.
To be in the supermarket checkout. He was on NBC national news.
Right. Well, just in the last minute, because I really wanted to get to this, David. Just what the New York Times investigation finds, that when the Fred Trump empire was sold, Donald Trump got a windfall, but he left money on the table, and that the master deal maker actually made a bad deal and sold low.
Well, yes, and that's because, of course, Donald is not a businessman. He is a cash extractor. I've talked to people about that deal, but never had the documents. The New York Times has to write about it. But yes, he made a very bad deal. He'd be much better off today if they had kept the properties. That's why Fred Trump wanted forever for his ancestors to hold on to these properties. And it goes to the fact that, well, Donald claims to be a great negotiator. I've negotiated with Donald many times. He's a horrible negotiator. And he's really horrible. What he does is he finds somebody with a vulnerability. He knows somebody is trying to do a deal and they've got to close at a certain date because they need the cash for something else, and he uses that against them. He does what's called competitive negotiation, not cooperative. In cooperative negotiation, you and I can make a deal, Ian, and we both come out ahead. In competitive, one of us comes out vanquishing the other, and that's how Donald talks all the time. So it's not at all surprising that he made a bad deal. It is, however, a bad deal in which he walked away with, in today's money, almost a quarter of $1 billion.
Right. We should all be so lucky to make such bad deals. I thank you, David. We've run out of time, but I very much appreciate you filling us in on this important New York Times story.
Take care. Ian.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and bestselling author of The Making of Donald Trump. He's lectured on economics, journalism, and tax policy on every continent except Antarctica, and is a former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors. And he recently co-founded DCReport.org, and his latest book is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into what happened to Lindsey Graham. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, The Fierce Urgency of Now, and his latest book is The Presidency of Barack Obama, The First Historical Assessment. And he is the co-host of the Politics and Polls podcast, and he has an article at The Atlantic, What Happened to Lindsey Graham? Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And Lindsey Graham, of course, has become the most zealous champion of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Some people feel that he's jumped the shark in that extremely emotional outburst he had in the hearing last week. But just to sort of go back a little bit, do you think that the death of John McCain, who was sort of Lindsey Graham's, well, he was certainly one of his closest friends, but you could make the case perhaps that he was his sort of moral conscience, that once John McCain passed, that Lindsey Graham was free to become more of an acolyte of Donald Trump's than his friend John McCain would have been comfortable with?
To some extent, I do think Senator Graham, even though he's often thought of also as a bit of a maverick or a moderate, he really isn't. Since the 90s, he's been a pretty loyal member of both the Republican Party and the right wing of the party, and he's usually really aligned with the most extreme forces. I think Senator McCain might have offered something of a little bit of a pushback to those tendencies, a little bit, but I think what you saw in the hearings was really Senator Graham unleashed being who he is these days, because he has been very loyal to President Trump, and he really hasn't challenged him as much as some thought he might.
And do you think that this is something to do with the fact that he's up for re-election in 2020 and probably will be challenged in South Carolina from the right?
It is. I think that's part of it, and so he certainly wants President Trump's support for his election. There's other speculation that he's aiming for some kind of position in the cabinet, perhaps attorney general, if that position opens up, and that might also be on his mind. And it could also just be who he is, and that the characterization of him as somehow a voice of the center really isn't true, other than on a few issues. So it's probably some combination of all three.
Well, there is, I think, reason to suspect that he wants to become the next attorney general. We know that the current attorney general is embattled, and there are rumors. And in fact, recently, Hillary Clinton on MSNBC, speaking with Rachel Maddow, said that she expects a wholesale purge of the White House after this election is over, and that Jeff Sessions, of course, will go, Rosenstein will go, even the adults, the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, perhaps even the Chief of Staff. And under those conditions, of course, we'd end up with the White House effectively being run by Bill Schiner, Fox, Corey Lewandowski, and Stephen Miller. So what do you think of that speculation?
It could be. The speculation of this purge, though, has been going on for a while at this point. And the one thing I've certainly observed with President Trump is he doesn't really have a long-term strategy. He's reactive. He really seems to believe in working and within the news cycle and trying to shape it on a hour-by-hour, if not day-to-day basis. And so while that might be on his mind, it might be a plan, it might be what would happen, I'm not sure anyone knows, including people in the White House, including the president himself. I think it will really be where the situation is at that moment. He is very confident in himself, and I do think he is confident that he's running the show regardless of who surrounds him. He obviously would love to end the Russia probe, but how he does that, I think it's still up in the air. Again, I think it will be when we reach that point, he will know where he's going with this.
Well, when Lindsey Graham made that outburst in defense of Kavanaugh, his excuse over why they held up Judge Merrick Garland for 10 months was pretty lame. It was almost like slipped in as an afterthought. And to my sense is that really was a turning point. And obviously things are really partisan. It seemed like an almost total accident. There happened to be a friendship between Senator Coons and Senator Flake that has given us this little bit of a reprieve with this further investigation of Kavanaugh by the FBI, which, again, the Republicans, particularly Chairman Grassley, seem to have sabotaged. I don't know whether they've lost 3 days out of the seven. They're supposedly going to pick up some steam, but whatever's going on now is all rather opaque, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think the process has been becoming much more polarized for several decades, but I think the Republicans certainly took it to a new level. First, with Obama as president before Garland, they held up an unprecedented number of federal court appointments. This was part of why Harry Reid was willing many years ago to get rid of the filibuster, because he was just so frustrated with the kind of hardball tactics they were employing. Obviously, just simply not even meeting or considering Merrick Garland was pretty stunning. And I think all norms at that point were broken. And in some ways, I think what's happened with this confirmation isn't so much about Democratic payback. It's actually an extension of the hardball Republican tactics. I mean, putting him forward and putting him forward the Judiciary Committee after that testimony is a pretty bold move for a Republican Party. He disqualified himself in multiple ways, I think, but the party held firm, and we'll see what they do when they actually vote on the floor. But we're in a new era. I think that's fair to say. This is not normal politics, and it's going to be very hard to rebuild norms to make this process different at this point.
And again, I'm speaking with Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, whose books include Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, The Fierce Urgency of Now, and his latest book is The Presidency of Barack Obama, A First Historical Assessment. And he is the co-host of the Politics and Polls podcast, and he has an article at The Atlantic, What Happened to Lindsey Graham? So turning to your article, it reminds us that, in effect, Lindsey Graham was a congressman on the House Judiciary Committee, one of the leading voices in the impeachment of Bill Clinton. Of course, the House makes the case. The Senate votes on the case. In many ways, I think his performance on the Judiciary Committee probably helped him get elected to the Senate in South Carolina. But while he was serving on the House of Representatives in 1999, for example, he talked about perjury, which he wasn't taking lightly, as he seems to be doing today. This is what he said to the Senate in the appeal to the Senate after the House of Judicial Committee had passed out the recommendation of impeachment of Bill Clinton. He said that, I have argued to you that when you found that a judge was a perjurer, you couldn't in all good conscience send him back in a courtroom, because everybody that came in that courtroom thereafter would have a real serious doubt. Different, well, I guess I'm suggesting there's an element of hypocrisy here.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable to look back at the 98-99 period. He was one of the most vocal supporters of impeachment. And for Bill Clinton, one of the major arguments, he said, it wasn't about sex, it was about perjury. And of course, he was talking about the president. But the main, the basis of his argument was that many judges, federal judges had been impeached for committing perjury on all sorts of issues. And he made a case again and again and again about how serious this is and how it really undermines the integrity of institutions when a high-level official had done this. And I even found an article in 1999, once this all ended, where Kavanaugh, with two other lawyers who had worked for Kenneth Starr, defended Ken Starr and defended this argument about the serious nature of perjury and said Clinton had no one to blame but himself for lying during a grand jury testimony and elsewhere. So there's a lot of hypocrisy going on, but in some ways it's an argument Democrats might certainly want to consider if it's a legitimate argument. I think this might be one way in the next few days where Democrats have a very strong case to make to people like Lindsey Graham that he disqualified himself last week during that very dramatic afternoon. If it turns up, he just said many, many things that have no bearing in fact.
Well, some of the things that he said about the yearbook were clearly lies. Most people found it totally unconvincing. The Devil's Triangle and all these sort of teenage references were pretty clear what they were about. Those are probably, to the mind of most people, bordering on, what would you say, white lies.
Uh-huh.
But the fact that he already knew about the Ramirez woman before the New Yorker article came out and apparently talked to Senator Hatch about it and then in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee denied that he had any foreknowledge, that's impeachable, isn't it?
Well, he doesn't even need to. I mean, well, he could be impeached, so he could be there. But at a minimum, in terms of confirmation, I think, yes, that's more than enough reason for a senator to turn their vote from yes to no. And I do think it's serious. Obviously, the discussion was about allegations of sexual assault, a pretty serious charge. And if he chose not to tell things to the committee or to say things in that case that were not true, that says a lot for someone who's about to be appointed to the Supreme Court. And I think the real question now is this handful of senators, Flake, Collins, Murkowski, who have not made their decision. And I think Democrats have turned to this issue this afternoon, and I'm not totally surprised because I think there's a pretty compelling, clear-cut case. Whereas on what happened in the summer of in the 1980s of 1982 will always be more difficult to prove in clear-cut fashion. So we'll see. In the end, Republicans might say they don't care. They might say, well, Senator Graham, our colleague, was wrong back in the 1990s. But it is an issue. Even Senator Flake has indicated troubled him. It wasn't one lie. It wasn't just one small lie. This seemed to be an entire testimony where he was making up a past that was not really who he was and doing it to defend himself from these allegations.
So what do we know, Julian Zelizer, about the relationship between Ken Starr and Brett Kavanaugh, who was his sort of right-hand man? And if you look at some of the recommendations that Kavanaugh made to the lawyers that were going to interview or depose President Clinton, he wanted them to go for the jugular and really get into the more prurient details of Bill Clinton's sexual activities with Monica Lewinsky. So it's pretty clear that he was quite zealous about going after Clinton. So what was the relationship between Starr and his right-hand man Kavanaugh and Lindsey Graham and Henry Hyde and all those other people on the House Judiciary Committee? Because the case that they were making to the Senate to impeach Bill Clinton was based upon information coming from Kavanaugh and Starr, surely.
That's exactly right. And so Kavanaugh revered Starr. He would call him an American hero when this was over and was really personally angry with all of the critics of the Star Report, including the Clintons, who came up in Kavanaugh's testimony the other day. So he was very close to him. He saw him as something of both a hero and a mentor, and he was right at the center of that Star Report. And Star really drove the basis of the entire impeachment with the famous report that essentially outlined a process whereby the president had lied about his relationship and then tried to curtail the investigation. And the Republicans on the Hill, Graham, Gingrich, Hyde, and others really worked very closely with the prosecutor's office and made sure that report came out and was distributed very widely. So this is a network of partisan Republicans. That's what we're talking about from the 1990s. And one of them is now front and center. And in some ways, people shouldn't have been so surprised with his demeanor because this is the kind of figure he is. He's even different than Robert Bork in many ways. He's not a conservative jurist so much as part of this partisan network.
Well, he's been a political operative for the Republicans. He was down in Florida 2000. He was also, he handled the Elian Gonzalez case.
Right.
So he's almost like a Zelig-like figure, isn't he?
He is, and that's why it is remarkable this was the appointee of the president. It's not actually someone, even if you understand the history of the Federalist Society and the way in which conservative justices have been nurtured and brought through the ranks, who is an obvious choice and to be on the Supreme Court. Even when he was appointed to the federal court, there was a lot of opposition on the same issues, other than the new one, which is a history of sexual assault, that allegation. So, yes, you're talking about a partisan. You heard who he is from his own rhetoric. And now the Senate Republicans have to make a decision. But their bias is always to stand firm, and it takes a lot to have the Republicans vote against any decision that a member of their own party has made. So still, I think that's where this will probably end up.
So just in closing, you think that Friday, apparently, my understanding is that they'll get the report from the FBI on Friday. It goes to every member of the Senate. Surely they need some time to digest it before they vote.
Well, we would think, but on the same at the same time, Senator McConnell has made very clear he wants this finished. And when the hearings themselves happened, the Judiciary Committee hearings, one of the complaints of Democrats was information was being dumped on them at the last minute. They didn't even have a lot of information, which now certainly looks more relevant. And so my guess is I don't think Senator McConnell is going to give time to digest. I think as soon as this report is out, he is going to try to force the vote as quickly as possible. So it will really come down to those Republicans, the swing Republicans, the undecided Republicans. Do they use their muscle to stop this, to slow it down at a minimum, or do they ultimately cave to McConnell's pressure? And McConnell is not going to want to give time.
And you think the Democrats, the two wavering ones, Heitkamp and Manchin, you would think they have enough cover now to vote with their caucus.
Yeah, they should. At this point, they should feel comfortable. But they're feeling pressure within their state still. And they haven't affirmatively come out that way. And so that indicates to me they're still on the fence, and they're certainly worried politically about the implications of voting no. But they have a lot of cover on this one if they want to go with the party.
Well, Julian Zelizer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, whose books include Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, The Fierce Urgency of Now, and his latest book is The Presidency of Barack Obama, A First Historical Assessment. And he is the co-host of the Politics and Polls podcast, and he has an article at The Atlantic, What Happened to Lindsey Graham? We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an assessment of what kind of an improvement over NAFTA is Trump's new USMCA agreement.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound. It's all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Gold, a professor of law at Fordham University, where he teaches international trade law. He frequently consults with U.S. business on the renegotiations of NAFTA and other U.S. trade agreements, and has been consulted by the White House, National Security Council staff, State Department, and members of Congress on issues at the intersection of trade and national security. And he previously held an appointment within the executive office of the president as the Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for North America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Gold.
Great to be here, Ian.
So what do you make of the USMCA? I mean, I was just thinking, you know, when Trump announced it, he could have had the background music of the village people singing YMCA and changing it to UMCA. What do you think of that?
The new NAFTA is what I expected. The new NAFTA has a series of updates, mostly things that were in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which the United States, Mexico, and Canada were all parties to, along with nine other countries, which President Trump pulled the United States out of. So most of this is catch-up ball, getting back to where the Obama administration had left us when it left office. There are a couple of innovations beyond that in the new NAFTA. It's a modest improvement on the old NAFTA.
Well, apparently they were going through some of the combinations. Obviously, USMCA means U.S., Mexico, Canada. At one point, they thought about CAMUS, but that, of course, is a famous French novelist. So how would you then categorize this? Is this largely cosmetic? I mean, yesterday in the Rose Garden, President Trump congratulated himself and sort of made fun of people who criticize tariffs, saying it's the tariffs that brought them to the table, and implying that anybody thought the tariffs were a bad idea, were incredibly naive. And he basically says, this is, you know, I put the screws to them and we got good results. So what do you make of that?
I don't agree with that. What President Trump got were a series of changes that were mutually beneficial to all three countries. Had President Trump been willing to limit the agenda of the renegotiation to the issues where we actually made changes, then Canada and Mexico would have probably come to the table willingly, and President Trump would not have had to threaten to withdraw from NAFTA. He would not have had to impose the steel and aluminum tariffs, which violate our WTO obligations to Canada and Mexico, and he would not have done the enormous amount of damage that he did to the three economies with uncertainty, and to our relationships with Canada and Mexico, and to the credibility of the WTO trading system.
Well, but I guess the reality is here. This was a campaign promise. He was demagoguing NAFTA to win over working class Americans, which he did. At least that's the postmortem, in many ways, the criticism of Hillary Clinton. So how much do you attribute this to him, basically, his contract with his base?
Well, there's no question that the theater, the idea of claiming far more success than he actually had, is all about his base in the midterms. Sorry about that. Let me just, I got something in my throat.
Sure. So do I. I've had a cold for 2 weeks and I'm still coughing. Anyway, go ahead.
There's no question that yesterday's theater was about appealing to his base. On the campaign trail, President Trump described NAFTA as horrible and terrible and as being responsible for the loss of tens of thousands of U.S. manufacturing jobs and responsible for a trade deficit the United States has with Mexico. Now, none of that was true. We lost most of those manufacturing jobs to automation. The ones we lost to trade, we lost mostly to trade with China. And at the end of the day, even to the degree we lost a small number of those jobs to trade with Mexico, that was not caused by flaws in NAFTA. And at the end of the day, there was nothing you could do to NAFTA to fix it that would bring any of those jobs back. Now, this update to NAFTA will not bring any manufacturing jobs back from Mexico, and it will not have any impact on the U.S. trade deficit with Mexico. So the bigger picture of what President Trump promises constituents of the campaign trail and what he delivered are two completely different things. He did not deliver what he promised. What he did deliver was updating NAFTA with provisions that we've had in more recent free trade agreements and provisions that we had with Canada and Mexico under the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. And President Trump gave those up when he withdrew from the TPP, and he got, for the most part, the same things back with this NAFTA renegotiation.
And, of course, there are these side letters, are there not, granting exemptions from future American tariffs. And also, isn't there a long political path ahead? This deal is not done.
It's not done in the sense that it has to be approved by Congress, and then Congress also has to enact a statute which implements our obligations under the changes in the deal. But it is done in the sense that any American Congress will approve this agreement and will enact its implementing statute. Even the new Congress, which will be quite different than the old one. Looking at the numbers and doing the analysis, I'm quite convinced that President Trump's enablers are going to lose control of the House of Representatives, and I think there's at least a chance they'll lose control of the Senate. But I think any House and any Senate controlled by either party, in the end, despite all the noise that they'll make and the complaints that they'll offer, will approve this agreement and will enact its implementing legislation.
So, but going back to Trump's boasting in the Rose Garden yesterday that by imposing tariffs and being tough, he brought the Canadians and the Mexicans to heel, and we wouldn't have the deal without that. I mean, the damage that he did to Canada, because the Canadians actually did not like having their prime minister, who's quite popular, insulted and belittled in the way that he was. So do you think the deal will outlast that kind of lingering bitterness and, you know, anti-Americanism? There were movements afoot in Canada to boycott American goods right across the board.
Well, I definitely think that the way President Trump managed it did more damage than the improvements are worth. But there's a long series of damages that he committed. First of all, to all three economies with uncertainty. Second of all, damaging the relationships between the countries, which you just referred to. But it goes beyond Canadians boycotting American goods. Remember, after September 11th, Canada sent thousands of their kids to Afghanistan to get shot at side by side with Americans because terrorists attacked the United States. And then later terrorists attacked Canada because they sent their military with us in a coalition to Afghanistan. The damage done, big picture, long term, to national security to that relationship is quite concerning. At the same time, you also have these international trade agreements, especially the ones at the World Trade Organization, to which 164 countries are parties. That's all part of international law, which is what we call the world order, and it enhances America's power in the world, especially when facing off against the Russians and Chinese. And President Trump severely undermined all of the international law of international trade when he imposes the aluminum and steel tariffs by violating the most fundamental rules at the World Trade Organization, rules that the United States authored and persuaded the rest of the world to sign on to. And that also really injures the U.S. national security in the global stage. And he violated those rules to impose the steel and aluminum tariffs on Mexico and Canada and try to gain leverage, and he gained very little leverage from doing that.
Well, there's an op-ed in Tuesday's New York Times by Professor Flores Macias and of Cornell and Professor Sanchez Talenquer of the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics, and they're basically saying this is worse than NAFTA. Their argument is that the deal eliminates these expert panels for resolving government investor disputes. And then the other one is that the agreement sets up a mechanism for automatically reviewing its terms on a periodic basis. And they argue that this creates a constant threat to exit the agreement, which shortens the investors' timeline horizons and is unsettling in terms of investors. What do you make of those arguments?
Well, the improvements on the whole, the changes on the whole definitely improve the agreement. And there's hundreds of changes that each one improves the agreement in small ways. Those particular issues, I agree, detract from the agreement. I think the investor state provisions in NAFTA and in the United States, other free trade agreements, I think are very much a good thing. And I think the people who oppose them really truly don't understand what they are and how they work. And that's the only reason why people oppose them. And they are being greatly diminished in the new NAFTA. So I think that is a step backwards. Also, the sunset provision is also a step backwards as well. I mean, it's not a 5-year sunset, it's a 16-year sunset. But I think that having any provision that automatically ends the agreement at any point in time, should the countries not agree to continue it, does create uncertainty. And it's less of a problem now, but 10 years from now, it'll start becoming a real problem. Hopefully, the three countries will agree to do away with that after President Trump's no longer president and long before the 16-year review comes into play.
Well, there's a general feeling emerging amongst experts and historians, for that matter, who have a longer view, that what's happening to the United States at the moment under Donald Trump is that it's kind of government by stunt, like a TV reality show, that he's always just had to throw out shiny objects for the press to seize on, and that this deal, which is largely cosmetic, is another shiny object tossed out there after months and months of disruption. And that what's going on in the broader sense is that we have a government that's only interested in short-term cosmetic fixes at the expense of long-term damage, and that there's been a massive defection from the U.S. government at all levels of expertise. In other words, the intellectual capital that the United States government has just been diminished because people have just quit in droves. We've lost one-third of our government workforce. Does that ring true to you? And do you see it as being as troubling as I see it?
Well, first of all, the idea of declaring victory after failure is not new to President Trump, nor is political face saving in many forms. But President Trump has taken it to a whole nother order of magnitude. And certainly with respect to the trade policy we're talking about right now, his renegotiation of the South Korea-U.S. free trade agreement was a complete failure, and they declared victory. His confrontations on trade with Europe was a complete failure, and Jean-Claude Juncker came over and they shook hands and pretended they had a success. He got no concessions out of South Korea, and he got no concessions out of Europe. And even this NAFTA renegotiation, the items that Trump wanted that really involved concessions from Mexico and Canada, almost entirely he didn't get. He only got the things that were of mutual benefit, and all the bluster was damage done for no reason. So, yeah, Trump has taken it to a new order of magnitude where he causes a lot of damage, then fails completely, and then declares victory. As far as the departure of federal government employees that you referenced, I would be stunned if it were correct that one-third of the federal career workforce had resigned. That would be a staggeringly large number. I'm not aware of the numbers anyway that are big. But in certain areas, like our diplomatic corps, the U.S. Foreign Service, which is one portion of the career employees in the State Department, and also people like the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, which are the trade diplomats, in certain specific areas, we have lost an enormous amount of talent, and that's the kind of expertise that takes decades to develop in each person, and it's a big loss.
So we talked earlier, Matt Gold, about how Canada, the entire Canadian people sharing the most peaceful border in the world with the United States, have been really upset by Trump's treatment of their prime minister, who's quite popular. Even recently, of course, Trump went out of his way at the UN to say that he canceled a meeting, which was an insult to Trudeau, again belittling him. And of course, it turned out that no such meeting was planned in any case. But again, that was a put down of Trudeau. On the Mexican side, though, what do you make of that? I mean, AMLO, the new Mexican leader, seems to be totally on board with this deal. And of course, he's a socialist. In case you hadn't noticed, Trump and the Republicans are trying to make socialism the bête noire in this midterm election, accusing all kinds of Democrats of being socialists.
Well, in Mexico, AMLO, I think his top priority was not to have to get into a fight with Trump because of the domestic political minefield that would involve. Second, I think he did not want to have ownership of the details of the labor provisions. There were improvements in requirements on Mexico for how it treats its labor and manufactured goods that are exported to the United States. But, you know, those improvements were not as strong as they could have been, and I'm not sure that AMLO, who is a champion of the worker, wanted necessarily to have ownership of those. I think he preferred his predecessor to negotiate them, close them, and sign them. So I think his desire to avoid a fight with Trump and to avoid ownership of the details of the agreement compelled him to encourage his predecessor, Enrique Peña Nieto, to finish it out and the United States to finish it out and get it signed. And it will probably be signed on Enrique Peña Nieto's last day in office.
Which is December the 1st.
Or November 30th, yeah.
Yeah, right. I'm sorry, yeah.
Well, yeah. They'll change power on December 1st, but his last full day in office will be November 30th.
Right. So let's just wrap it up then, Matt Gold. Summarizing, as you know, it is cosmetic. There have been some changes, and it sounds like not much. It's been tinkering, no great damage. How would you describe it?
I would describe it as almost a pure positive. There are very few changes that I think are negative. Almost all the changes are positive. They're nowhere near the kinds of changes that would impact the American economy the way Trump promised. They're mostly catch-up ball to get back what Trump gave up in TPP. But they are positive, and since the damage done to attain them is already water under the bridge, evaluating the agreement on its own right now, there's no reason not for Congress not to approve it.
But just in closing, do you think Trump can claim that he's winning on trade?
I can claim he's winning the PR battle and the political theater battle, but in terms of actually improving America's position on trade, he's making it far worse.
Well, Matt Gold, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Gold, who's a professor of law at Fordham University, where he teaches international trade law. He frequently consults with U.S. business on the renegotiations of NAFTA and other U.S. trade agreements, and has been a consultant to the White House, the National Security Council staff, State Department, and members of Congress on issues at the intersection of trade and national security. And he previously held an appointment within the executive office of the president as the Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for North America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.